This is a CBC podcast.
Piracy for profit, possible presidents, and political puppet shows. Those are your keywords. I'm Jesse Brown, and this is Search Engine. Last week on our show, we opened up an online discussion on the future of music in an era where listeners can choose whether or not they'd like to pay for the music they listen to. Specifically, we asked you the question, who needs the protection? Artists or listeners? Now, as coincidence has it, as that conversation was progressing on our blog, some surprising news emerged that challenges the most basic assumptions about the effect that internet downloads are having on the music industry. The big surprise being, downloads are actually increasing CD sales. That's what an independent study conducted by Industry Canada has just found, and with me to talk about it is Michael Geist, the Canada Research Chair of Internet and E-Commerce Law at the University of Ottawa. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Jesse.
Michael, what did Industry Canada find about the impact of music downloads on the purchase of music?
Well, they found that those that don't download, those that generally for the Canadian population, there isn't a significant impact, either negative or positive. But perhaps even more significantly, they found a positive correlation between people who engage in peer-to-peer downloading and people who buy music. In fact, they found that on a monthly basis, for every person that downloads yet one more song, they're likely to buy about a half a CD more. So a couple of downloads a month equals one extra CD purchased every month. So they found a fairly strong correlation between people who engage in peer-to-peer and people who buy music.
So illegal file downloading is good for the sale of physical CDs.
Well, that's precisely what this study found. It found, and it should be noted that unlike some of the other studies that have been conducted on these issues, where they're typically one side or the other who's trying to prove a particular point, this is an instance where we've got the government commissioning a study. They're actively engaged in the questions that were asked and the way that it was conducted. They asked more than 2,000 Canadians and then got independent economists at the University of London to assess the data. And the outcome is unequivocal. It's very clear that taken as a whole in Canada, peer-to-peer isn't having a negative impact on the sale of CDs. And looking specifically at those who engage in peer-to-peer, it's actually a positive correlation.
Well, I guess this gets kind of complicated, but the bottom line is sort of interesting. It seems to suggest that what open information advocates have been suggesting for years, that essentially the same people who are supposedly criminals are also the customers, and that people who do download music illegally are also the same people who buy CDs.
In some ways, we should have expected this, because what peer-to-peer has become for so many music fans is the place where they find music. And at a time when particularly the younger generation isn't listening to radio and they can't find anyway the kind of newer selections and newer groups, it's peer-to-peer that's one of those primary sources. And what the study suggests is that many times they'll discover music on those peer-to-peer systems and then go ahead and buy the CD.
So the idea is that the peer-to-peer acts as a promotion, a taste test before you go out and buy the thing.
Absolutely. In many ways, it becomes a primary promotional vehicle. And indeed, we've seen a lot of Canadian artists recognize that. I think it's important to recognize that 90% of new Canadian music is created not by these large foreign labels that have been pushing for copyright reform and to address peer-to-peer, but instead are created by independent labels who haven't embraced copy controls and anti-copying technology. And indeed, many of them have recognized that the internet is probably one of their best distribution models.
Michael, as you said, this is an objective study that was commissioned by the government. We've been waiting for new copyright legislation from our federal government for a while. Is there a chance that this will affect that legislation?
Well, I think that's the unfortunate side to the story, because I think there's every sense that we are going to get copyright reform legislation in Canada. Indeed, the recent speech from the throne indicated that the government was committed to doing so. But every indication we have is that rather than looking ahead in terms of recognizing what's taking place in the marketplace and even recognizing this kind of independent study, what we're going to see is legislation that looks back almost 10 years, that reflects the sorts of policies and lobbying that we've seen for more than a decade from some of those major record labels, the RIAA in the United States, the Canadian Recording Industry Association in Canada. So the kind of legislation that we're likely to see, not only is it not going to account for these kind of studies, but it's likely to run directly contrary to the evidence that the government itself has now unearthed.
Well, we haven't seen this legislation yet. How do you know that, Michael?
That's a fair point. But certainly the scuttlebutt from talking to politicians, from talking to policymakers, indeed talking to many of the stakeholders around the process, is that the pressure that they're facing from some of these lobby groups, and indeed also from the United States, which you may recall pressured Canada very heavily in the spring over anti-camcording legislation, is such that the government is likely to move. I think that if the government was taking a look at what's really taking place in the marketplace, they'd be embracing a series of reforms, ones that look ahead, ones that recognize that openness, ones that recognizing that an effective fair use or fair dealing provision are the kinds of things that are really driving innovation and creating new economic value.
Well, I guess we'll find out soon enough when this legislation is announced.
I think sooner rather than later is certainly the indication we've been getting from the government.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
Well, with this new information to chew on, our online discussion continues. To join in, visit our blog at cbc.ca/search engine and look for the post asking, who needs the protection, artists or listeners? Last Tuesday was the first Tuesday in the month of November, which means that we've got about exactly 1 year to go before Americans head to the polls to elect their next president. Given the current president's approval ratings, the lowest in history, and also the sinking American dollar, the unpopular Iraq war, and a Democratic opposition in the midst of a complete identity crisis, it's anyone's guess how this will all play out. So far, the only thing that pundits all agree on is that this will be the most wired election in history. Google any major candidate and you'll find not only an official web page, but an official MySpace page, Facebook group, and YouTube channel. You can also download a Barack Obama ringtone to your cell phone if you so desire.
Go, 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 Obama, Obama, oh!
Major debates have already been held through MySpace and YouTube, and each campaign has a dedicated team of internet advisors managing their candidates' online presence. But what role exactly will the internet play in the upcoming election? Who will it help, and who will it burn? And more importantly, will the internet fulfill its promise of transforming American participatory politics into something more, well, participatory? No one knows for sure, but our next guest's guesses may be better than most. Mika Sifri is a former editor of The Nation magazine who left print to co-found the websites Personal Democracy Forum and Tech President. He joins me now from our New York studios to guide us through the online battle so far and the online battle to come. This week, he'll take us through the Democrats' internal battle on the web, and next week, he'll return to Search Engine to talk about the Republicans. Hello, Mika.
Hi, Jesse. How's it going?
It's good. Now, Canadians pay close attention to American presidential politics, but maybe not as close attention as you've been paying. So let's begin by just having a look at where we are right now. And according to the CNN poll, we've got on the Democratic side Hillary Clinton dominating Barack Obama. And if I go to your site, to techpresident.com, and I look at the stats, they paint a bit of a different picture. Can you tell me how they differ from these mainstream
sure.
polls?
Sure. Well, what we're looking at on techpresident.com is a variety of measures that show the intensity of interest and support for candidates online. And there are two kinds of things that we look at in particular. One is the expressions of support that they're getting on big social networking sites like MySpace and Facebook, where lots of people are signing up as friends of the major candidates. And the other kind of thing we're looking at is the sort of organic interest in the candidates that gets expressed because their name gets mentioned in a blog post or because somebody goes and watches videos that the candidates are making on sites like YouTube. These are both good ways to get a sense of just how much People are looking for these candidates.
And looking looking right now at your stats, it's a very different picture than the mainstream CNN poll. On MySpace, we have Obama dominating Clinton. It seems that the people who are on top online are not the people who are on top, according to CNN.
Well, actually, it's a mixed bag. For the most part, what you just said is absolutely true. What we're seeing is, in some cases, this is like the digital equivalent of bumper stickers on your cars. You may go driving and see a lot of bumper stickers for a candidate. That doesn't necessarily mean it will translate into votes, but it does tell you something about intensity of support. The challenge for the campaigns is how do you translate these very lightweight expressions of support into things that really matter, like money, votes, volunteers. And this is, you know, a big question here will be, is it just going to be about money and their ability to spend money on television ads, which has traditionally been the case? Or will all this grassroots support, which we see the tip of the iceberg of online, turn into and be organized by the campaigns into intensive door-knocking and field organization?
Well, Micha, I guess it's hard for us to know exactly what the internet aspect of these campaigns will mean in the year to come, but we can maybe get a clearer picture of what it has meant so far up till now. And I guess the most visible thing that we've seen from the campaigns is the birth of this of the viral clip, which seems to be playing quite a big role this time around. I guess the first one that caught my attention was the Vote Different Obama clip.
One month ago, I began a conversation with all of you, and so far, we haven't stopped
talking. So what this was a mashup. A freelancer who knew how to use video editing software took an old ad that had been made by Apple Computer back in 1984 when they were positioning themselves as the liberating force against the big brother of IBM. And what this person did is he stuck Hillary Clinton's face on the big screen as if she were Big Brother, with a person appearing as the Obama, as the liberator. And this ad was placed on YouTube and initially got some attention from the blogs where, you know, people shared it. It was very compelling. And it got a couple hundred thousand views, and then the mainstream media noticed. And in a matter of days, it went from a few hundred thousand to a couple million views. It's now probably one of the most viewed political videos ever. And what you need to realize is it was made by somebody over the course of a weekend with a few hundred dollars of hardware and software.
Who was the person who made this?
It was a guy named Phil DeValise, who initially posted the video under a pseudonym. There was a bit of a guessing game as to, you know, who did this. And, you know, this is one of the new questions about online phenomenon affecting politics is the ability for other campaigns potentially to play dirty tricks on their opponents or on the public at large. And ultimately, the Huffington Post unmasked him. And it turned out that he had worked actually for a Democratic consulting firm that was itself on retainer to the Obama campaign. The point about the Vote Different video is that this was really the first example of voter-generated content, which we believe is really the wild card of politics these days. It's not so much what the campaigns do with the web. It's what ordinary people can do with the web now to reach millions of others. The campaigns are trying to do it, too.
What's interesting to me is that we have a ping pong game happening where voter-generated content, as you call it, seems to be people taking political campaign ads into their own hands and making their own at home. And then almost instantly we see the campaigns doing their own mashups and sampling and almost acting as if they were just citizens. You know, we all know about political spin after a debate, after anything happens, each camp kind of figures out how they want to present it. After the MTV MySpace debate on this past October 30th, Hillary Clinton's people released this Politics of Pylon video.
Senator Clinton.
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 Hillary Clinton.
Senator 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 Clinton.
Hillary.
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 Hillary Clinton.
Hillary is the first lady,
and now Senator Clinton.
I seem to be the topic of great conversation and consternation, and that's for a reason.
And then the title comes on and it says, The Politics of Pylon.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting to me is that I understand this got folded into a larger kind of pack of messages that that the Hillary Clinton campaign was releasing about that debate. Maybe you could expand on that a bit.
The news cycle, they used to say that, you know, there might be a couple of beats over the course of the day to the news cycle. It's completely been flattened out now. It's just continuous. And the campaigns are very savvy and realize that reporters are all checking their email constantly and looking at what is floating around on the web and what other campaigns are putting up and spreading around. They don't need to make a TV ad anymore. They just need to make a quick cut of any kind of video. And if it's good, they put it up. It's the best way for them to do quick response. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, what happened with this Hillary video where she was basically trying to say, look, all the boys are ganging up on me, the one woman. That was the initial post-debate message that the Hillary campaign started to spread in the wake of that debate, where all the other candidates indeed are attacking her because she's the front runner. And it kind of backfired. And people actually came back with a wonderful counter response.
Well, let's have a listen to the John Edwards campaign's response to the Politics of Pylon video. This one's called The Politics of Parsing. Just to give you some visual information here, what we're seeing is a split screen, Hillary Clinton's image on both sides of that split screen, footage taken from different points at that same debate. And I suppose the implication here is that she is contradicting herself. She's giving two different answers to each question.
I stand for ending the war in Iraq, bringing our troops home. We're going to have troops remaining there guarding our embassy. We may have a continuing training mission, and we may have a mission against Al-Qaeda in Iraq. But on specific issues, I've come out with very specific plans. With respect to Social Security, I do have a plan. But personally, I am not going to be advocating any specific fix until I am seriously approaching fiscal responsibility.
Now, if you compare the number of views to these two videos, these are really the biggest salvos that were fired in the wake of that debate. The Edwards video, the Politics of Parsing, I think has close to 250,000 views now on YouTube.
Over it. I'm looking at it now. It's 274,000 and then
some. Okay. It's been going up since this morning. And the Clinton one, I think, was at around 70, 75,000 views.
It's under that. It's 72.6. So,
yeah.
So that's really interesting that the initial comment was nowhere near as powerful as the response to that. I guess you've got to be careful when you enter into this. You can't control the message the way that maybe you used to.
The fact is that they've lost control and they're swimming in an environment where they're going to be buffeted by this constantly. You will see truth squads. You will see groups of you know, citizen video activists, you know, mashing up their own clips where they find examples of the candidate saying one thing and then saying another thing. And there's nothing that people dislike more than, you know, catching a politician in that kind of hypocrisy.
Well, I think it's interesting, and all of this seems to be that everything is on the record and everything is up for grabs. I want to play you a clip that I'm sure you're well familiar with. The title of this on YouTube is Kentucky Fried Hillary, and this is this is Hillary Clinton. I think she's addressing a largely black audience.
I don't feel no ways tired. I come too far from where I started from. Nobody told me that the road would be easy. I could have listened all afternoon. That pulse that you found so faint, you have brought back to life.
So there we have Senator Clinton laying on this very thick Southern accent that she suddenly acquired.
Yeah. And what that video, the Kentucky Fried Hillary video, is showing is something that politicians have gotten away with for a very long time, which is showing different faces to different folks. And yet she's still doing pretty well in the polls.
Right. Well, Micha, what you're saying seems to suggest that this is maybe a really positive thing, that in fact politicians have no choice but to be honest and transparent, because if they put on a false face, they're going to get caught. So, I mean, is this the dream of the internet, that we're going to have a more honest and forthright politics?
I think at the margin, this is where we're going. It's going to be harder for people to get away with, literally saying one thing, doing another.
Micha, I'm also curious about the other side of things. Is there a chance that all this level playing field and how anyone can have a say, can it cheapen politics? And I'm thinking specifically of Obama Girl.
Yeah.
Let's have a listen to this YouTube video that was released by a woman calling herself Obama Girl.
You seem to float onto the floor. Democrats.
I can't stop listening to it. It's very catchy.
It is, but you know, I think that CBC journalistic handbook tells me that I can't actually take a partisan position. But I think it's safe to say that that is a horrible song.
got a hook.
In the interest that this has been viewed in contrast with the clips we've been talking about earlier that were measured in the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands. This was viewed almost 4 million times.
Yes. Well, you know, get a pretty girl in a bikini and you know, you get millions of views on the web, too.
Now, to be fair to Obama and the other candidates, this was also met with responses for just about every other candidate, Dennis Kucinich, and pretty much everybody but Hillary Clinton has had a girl sing for them. And
none as good as this one, though.
Let's have a quick listen to some of these other songs. So those are all pretty bad songs. Mika, is this just degrading everything? I mean, I guess this kind of stuff has always been around, but it seems that politicians increasingly are even responding to these publicity grab videos.
Yeah. Well, you know, what the online video revolution has also done is created a huge number of job opportunities for aspiring songwriters and actors.
Well, for that, Mika, let us all be thankful. Mika, that's all the time we have for this today, but we have so much more to talk about. The Republicans, one Republican in particular, Ron Paul, who I suppose you could call him the darling of the internet. We'll hear more from you next week as we go into part two of this discussion of the internet's effect on the coming U.S. election. Mika, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure talking with you.
If you're just joining us, I'm Jesse Brown, and this is Search Engine, a radio show that predicts the present. Now, the internet may give Americans an unlikely president, but it has already given them some unlikely pundits. One of them is James Kotecki, a recent university grad who entered the field of political analysis while still in school about 9 months ago. Identifying himself on YouTube as Emergency Cheese, he began posting videos shot in his Georgetown University dorm room, which he co-hosted with puppets, made by taping photos of the heads of the major candidates onto pencils. Naturally, his online popularity has grown, and James has actually been able to wrangle interviews with many of these same key candidates, some of whom have actually joined him in his dorm room. Since graduating, James Kotecki has been hired by Politico.com as a full-time video blogger, and he joins me now from their offices in Washington, D.C. Hello, James.
Hello, Jesse. Great to be with you.
James, you very quickly, since you first set foot into politics, I guess, all of 9 months ago or so, you've become a respected political analyst. You interview major presidential hopefuls. You've been on CNN, Fox, NPR, BBC. It all happened very quickly, and I'm wondering if you can quickly tell us how it all happened. And please do start with the puppets.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was a Georgetown student back in January of early this year. I was a senior at Georgetown University. I had a webcam, and I decided to start making videos for the internet and put them up on YouTube. And to give the videos a little bit of a visual kick, I decided to cut out the heads of the presidential candidates that I'd printed out on pieces of paper, tape them to the backs of pencils, and flip them around in my videos. It's kind of a very low-tech, poor man's way of doing a little picture inset as a kind of like a newscast.
Okay. Well, give me a quick list. Who did you interview either in or from your dorm room?
Yeah, well, it's a funny story because I contacted many of the campaigns that actually had YouTube channels, and one of them got back to me. That was the campaign of Ron Paul, a Republican congressman from Texas, and his campaign was willing to take the risk of coming to a college kid's dorm room to do an interview in front of a webcam. And this is, in fact, the first time, to my mind, that had ever been done before in presidential political history. Since I got Ron Paul to come to my dorm room, it was easy to maybe approach other presidential candidates. I also had Mike Gravel, who's kind of a more obscure Democratic candidate for president, come to my dorm room. Mm-hmm. And after that, I interviewed Mike Huckabee, Dennis Kucinich, Duncan Hunter, Chris Dodd, and most prominently, John Edwards.
You know, it's interesting. Is it too casual? Is it undignified for these politicians to be, you know, making Sopranos references and coming to kids' dorm rooms? And it just seems a little bit, you know, less than presidential to me.
That certainly was the attitude that Governor Mitt Romney had when he was approached about the YouTube debate. YouTube, along with CNN, had hosted a Democratic debate where YouTube users would submit questions via video and candidates would answer these questions from quote-unquote regular citizens. Now, Mitt Romney, after watching that debate and watching one of the questions where a snowman, a kind of animated snowman, asked the Democratic candidates about global warming, Mitt Romney said, this is undignified, this is not something a presidential candidate should do, is to have to answer questions from a snowman. However, he was roundly criticized for that, and eventually, Mitt Romney agreed to do the Republican YouTube debate that's coming up in December.
So America's next president will likely be someone who will take a question from a snowman. James, how old are you?
I am 22 years old.
You're 22 years old.
Yes.
But you yourself have gone from being kind of this grassroots internet figure to you know, you're kind of flirting with the mainstream. You work for Politico.com, which is a site started by two Washington Post journalists. You get any flack on the web for selling out?
I did get a little bit of flack on the web, not as much as I had first expected. But the way that I think about it is I'm actually getting paid now by doing something that otherwise I would be doing for free because I love it so much. And I think that's the ideal for anybody, I think. I mean, if I could give you one piece of kind of trite advice, it's
please
try and get paid for something that you love doing. So I wish that everybody could say that they did that.
Do you still get to work with puppets?
I still have tried to put some pencil puppets in there because for whatever reason, the pencil puppets really resonate with people. So I promise to anyone out there who's concerned, I will always keep pencil puppets close to my heart and close to my videos.
Glad to hear it. James, you got a busy year ahead of you. Good luck.
Thank you very much, Jesse.
Search Engine is produced by myself, Jeff Siskind, Andrew Parker, our intern, Tashanta Pombwa, and the Search Engine online community. We make this show through online collaboration. To get involved, visit our site, cbc.ca/search engine, where you'll also find links and discussion on every story we've talked about, plus our podcast. You can also find us on the Facebook group, Search Engine CBC, or by email at searchengine@cbc.ca. I'm Jesse Brown. I have a cold. Thanks for listening. Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in. All of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.